The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Coming up on this week's show, Winamp is back again.
Final Fight comes to the Mega Drive.
And we chat with Reflections founder, Martin Edmondson.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our wonderful friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books you should absolutely check out if you love adventure games, they're back big style at the moment, is their third edition of the Art of Point and Click Adventure Games, celebrating the very best pixel art and classic scenes from the games that define that genre. We'll tell you more about that in just a bit, and check out the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 338, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Robbie Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, where every Friday we take you on a total nostalgia trip. So that's the aim of this podcast, not only to keep our gaming memories alive, but also to hear inside stories from the people and the companies who made the games that we grew up playing. And I think, you know, we cover all aspects of retro gaming on this show. Obviously, there's a lot of nostalgia in there, but there's so much happening in the retro gaming scene. It's not all about looking back 20, 30 years. We talk about, you know, collecting, new hardware add-ons for classic machines. The amount of new games that are made for retro consoles and retro computers each week, we can barely keep up with them all, can we? It's such a vibrant industry right now.
Totally, and like, I think nostalgia's good, but also a bit of history, because we talk about nostalgia. Sometimes you can have these like rose tinted glasses on when people talk about the past, and like with history, getting somebody on who we interview, you know, they actually tell us what happened in the day, and it's good to have like from the horse's mouth, because sometimes our memories like deceive us a bit, like what happened, you know, and each person has a different perspective on it. And I think that's really important. And also, you're totally right, like the news section, there's so much stuff coming out in the world of retro. It's just absolutely mental. And, you know, when we first started this, we thought, there's not going to be that much news going on, is there? There's not going to be that much happening. But my God, definitely a lot of stuff happening at the moment.
Yeah, the retro scene just keeps getting bigger and bigger, I think. But I think you made a good point there as well about, you know, why we do the interviews on this podcast too. Because I remember, you know, back in the pre-internet era, you'd often read like rumors in magazines or even like playground rumors at school. And you always wondered, like, is that really true? So it's amazing to actually get the people on who were behind the companies and the games that we played back in the day. So this week, we've got an absolute legend who is going to be joining us in the second half of the show. I'm going to be catching up with Reflections founder Martin Edmondson. Now, Reflections, I mean, if you talk about legendary British gaming companies, they do not come much bigger than Reflections.
Oh, God. We had a few technical hitches on this one. The interview sounds great, but I wasn't able to join Dan, and I wanted to so much, because, like, Martin Edmondson's someone that I've wanted to have on the podcast from the very beginning. Like, amazing score. He's such a good developer. Like, reflections, you know. They did like Ballistic Shadow of the Beast. They did a Destruction Derby and Driver as well. So they came from the Amiga, which they really, really pushed to its limits. And then they went into that PlayStation era. They also started on the BBC. And like the main thing about Reflections, I think, is the innovation in the games. They've always innovated and they've always pushed it to its cutting edge, absolute cutting edge. And like, do you remember the hype when Shadow of the Beast came out and how it must have sold a lot of Amigas and it must have got a lot of people involved with just those dropping graphics. But also,
well, that's the thing. I remember, you know, people at school who actually wanted an Amiga after they saw that game. Yeah. You know, as a graphical demo, it was like a showstopper.
It was amazing. But also like Destruction Derby and Driver, like Driver was such a cool, stylish game. Joe, what were your memories of Driver?
Oh, for Driver, for me, like me and my brother, well, my brother loved Driver. I really struggled with it. I found it so hard. And I'm really, really hoping that you asked him about like kind of like Driver and its relationship with GTA and kind of coming off back of that because
just stuck in the tutorial at the beginning.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like 100% stuck in that tutorial trying to do 360s and donuts around the pillars and stuff. But my brother always sold Driver to me as like it's 3D GTA. You know, and this is well before GTA 3 as well. Ultimately, it wasn't quite like that, you know. But then in number two, you could get out of the car and you could move, you know, you could steal other cars and stuff like that. There was that element to it. But like, I'm really, really excited to hearing about that and the development of it and kind of like where the idea came from. And if it kind of, I'm hoping you asked if it kind of did start out as kind of like a, we're trying to do a 3D GTA or, you know, what his thoughts were on that. So.
And it had that like
really excited about that
kind of 70s cop movie Starsky and Hutch style, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
The magazines back then always painted that GTA Driver kind of rivalry, didn't they?
Yeah,
they really were hyping that up. So we do go into that with Martin, and that Destruction Derby as well. I mean, that was a very early PlayStation 1 game. Got a feeling that was a launch title on the PS1, wasn't it?
I think it was, and then it was a launch title on the PS5. They redid it, didn't they? Like a little, you know, callback to that. So yeah, I'm excited to hear about that as well.
Because I remember playing that game with my brother, you know, when we first got our PlayStation. And it was just because I love racing games anyway, but actually having a driving game where the aim of it was to smash up the cars, you know, it was like nothing else I'd ever played before. So, you know, as a teenage lad, that's what life was all about. You want to smash cars. It was like the dream come true.
Yeah, and like so many companies as well kind of fell by the wayside when they went from the 16-bit to the 32-bit and going into that CD-ROM world as well. It was really tough. A lot of them went, and it was great to kind of play that and see like Psygnosis logos everywhere. You know, it's just really cool.
Yeah, so it's a really good chat this week. Martin Edmondson, who actually, I've got to say a big thank you to Martin because he's a very busy guy. He was in America last week. We couldn't make the time to work, but this week he's actually on a family holiday in Mallorca. He gives an hour of his holiday and he's actually poolside around the swimming pool in Mallorca on his phone in this chat. So you might hear the kids playing in the background and a bit of splashing water, but you're going to enjoy this week's guest. Reflections founder Martin Edmondson coming up in around 25 minutes from now. Now, the first half of the show, before we get into the interview, we kind of bring you up to speed on everything that's been happening, the main headlines in the world of retro gaming and technology. And this will be a sound that is all too familiar to anyone who used computers back in the mid to late 90s.
Winner. It really whips the llama's ass.
What memories does that bring back, Ravi?
Oh, God, so many. Like, Winamp for me was, and for many people, was kind of the player that was associated with downloading the MP3s. When you got your two tunes off Napster a night, you put them in Winamp. And what an amazing moment for me when I was a kid. Whereas I went to a LAN meeting where we all actually got our PCs and, you know, put them in your parents' car and then got dropped off. And being able to download free MP3 a night wasn't enough. You know, we turned up and these guys hooked me up to the LAN and then suddenly I had thousands of MP3s arriving and I'd just be scrolling through Winamp and it was a bit like, you know, a sign of your prowess how many MP3s you had. But it was a great piece of software. I even remember Icecast on there, which was like people doing radio streams. There was also a like video casting service where people would play like Simpsons episodes, Shoutcast as well. They'd be playing like Simpsons episodes 24 hours and you could tune into like a really low quality feed and watch stuff on there. It was really, really innovative, and it was an essential tool. And man, I just want Winamp back. Is it back?
It is. And actually, we've talked about this before, because this to me sounded very like, haven't we done this in the news a couple of years ago? Because do you remember, I think it was in around 2018, they brought back like a web version of Winamp briefly. And they said it was like a new company got the brand. They'd released like a version. They kept promising a proper update, but that never happened. So now it actually turns out you can download a new version of Winamp that runs on modern machines. The code base under the hood, that's been rewritten in Visual Studio 2019. That means that you do need Windows 7 Service Pack 1 or later to run it. So, you know, it's not going to run on Windows 98 or XP. But they're now saying this is kind of a new generation of Winamp. Although looking at it, it doesn't look like all that much has changed so far, I've got to say. But they are saying that apparently they're hoping that they're going to be able to integrate streaming services into this as well.
Wow.
So whether like in a few months' time or a few different revisions time, you'll be able to kind of put your Spotify library into there. I guess that's kind of the aim, depending on kind of how open their APIs are and that kind of thing.
Well, that was the thing. It was just consistent, wasn't it, Winamp? Like, it didn't change for all those kind of years. And then I guess like when VLC came out and stuff, it kind of like went out of trend, or like iTunes as well and stuff like that. But I love Winamp, and I think there's a lot of love and nostalgia for it, and the fact that you'll be able to run it on new machines. That's amazing. Do you remember Winamp, Joe? Or,
I feel really uninitiated here. Like, you know, I'm a little bit younger than you guys, and I recognize it. Like looking at it now, I recognize the UI and stuff, but when you played that advert, I was like, oh my God, I'm completely out of my depth here. And then, you know, and then I started chuckling to myself when Ravi said, you know, he gets his PCs in his parents' car and stuff. Can I imagine like 14-year-old, 10-year-old Ravi just being like, I'm online, I'm on Winamp, at his friend's house.
Well, also like, you know, it had a whole culture surrounding it. So stuff like Weird Al Yankovic kind of remixes of tunes and like these hyper nerdy kind of music stuff on there was all shared. And there was like, parody songs that were released and stuff, and
you see,
it was all part of that MP3 culture intertwined.
I'm familiar with all that, but I was such a LimeWire boy, you know, in like that early to mid 2000s, unfortunately. So I was probably seeing like the second round of all those songs, you know, like I said, the Weird Al Yankovic songs and the Tom Green parody songs and stuff like that. They probably all started on Winamp and then went on to LimeWire.
Well, thing is as well, I mean, back then, I don't know if it was the same, we were all kind of group of friends, but kind of MP3 hoarding was definitely a thing. And, you know, obviously swapping them with your friends and stuff as well. But kind of who had the biggest MP3 collection kind of became a bit of a sign of a
prowess. Because these tunes weren't findable online. So I even remember going to parties, and these were like cool parties with cool people. It wasn't like a nerd party. We'd turn up and there'd be a PC in the corner with Winamp with thousands of MP3s, and that would be hooked up to the sound system, and then people would go up and cue their tune up what they wanted to play. Like, it sounds so mad now when you can just like go on Spotify or just pick a tune off even YouTube, but back then, because the connections weren't that good, you know, that was your way to have this massive library of music.
Well, here's a question: who still has a big stash of MP3 files on the computer?
God, I don't think I do.
No, I don't anymore.
I might have a few FLAC tunes, but I don't.
I've still got my collection from 1999 onwards.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. Yeah. Or is it impressive? I don't know.
Or tragic, yeah, one of the two.
Is the quality really, really bad?
Yeah, there are some kind of CDs that I ripped, you know, in... I always did them at, like, at least 160, even back then, you know, when I just had, like, a... God, I think I had, like, a 4 or 5 gigabyte hard disk on my machine, and I'd rapidly fill it up.
Some like 28 kilobits or something like. So
just yeah, I mean, really, I always made like sure there were at least like one
quality.
Even when I downloaded them off Napster, I always aimed for like, you know, 128. But again, that took a while. I mean, it'd take a good, you know, hour or something to download them at least. But yeah, I've still got my collection. Must admit, I don't really use it all that often, but I've got it all on my NAS drive. It's all kind of sitting up there. And occasionally, because I've got a lot of kind of old DJ mixes that are on there, and maybe recordings of like, you know, essential mixes off Radio 1 from back in the day and stuff like that, that I'll occasionally fire up. FUBAR 2000 is generally my music player of choice. Although the old Winamp versions do actually still work on Windows 11, which I don't know if many people realize that, but you can actually still run kind of, you know, Winamp version 2 from 1999, 2000 on modern day Windows.
I play a lot of my stuff on VLC, but it just feels kind of soulless to me because it hasn't got that.
It's more a video player, isn't it, VLC? It feels like, Yeah, FUBAR 2000 is good, but Winamp, I think, you know, for a whole generation, it's just such a nostalgic look. Although I am looking, the company that actually owns Winamp now, if you look at their Twitter feed, they're really going down the kind of NFT route.
Oh, God, of course.
So they're getting well into that, which a lot of people are like,
we'll have to play guess the next piece of odd software that's going to become an NFT.
Yeah, like Kazaa, yeah. So, so interesting. But it is cool to see they're actually updating that kind of core product and bringing it back again. So should run flawlessly on your modern machine. So if you want to get hold of that, that new version of Winamp is available now. And I'll put the link to the article and the download link in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, this is a really cool story. Obviously, you're our kind of resident Streets of Rage fan, Joe. But on the other side, I mean, if you didn't have a Mega Drive, if you had a Super Nintendo, it was all about Final Fight back in the day. Although, I was thinking before, I thought, because this headline is that Final Fight is now coming to the Mega Drive. I was like, didn't it actually come out on the Mega Drive? But it turns out it was only on the Mega CD. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I don't want to get into a whole history lesson here of Final Fight and Streets of Rage and stuff. But yeah, no, you're totally right there, Dan. Final Fight came out in the arcade in, I say total history of it. I'm not a complete expert. I'm pretty sure it came out in 89 in the arcade. And then a few years later, 91, 92 time, we got the Super Nintendo port and the Sega CD port. So a lot would argue the Sega CD port is, you know, the closest you could get to the arcade. And the main thing is it had the two-player co-op on there, whereas the Super Nintendo version, which is obviously probably the more affordable version at the time and still is now, you could only play one player. Level 4 was missing, and one of the main characters was missing. You couldn't play as Guy. You could only play as Cody and Hagar. And then there was a new released version for the Super Nintendo like a year later called Final Fight Guy, where you could play as Guy, but you couldn't play as Cody. They just couldn't fit it all on the cartridge. And obviously then there's the Sega CD version where you got everything, but it wasn't quite arcade perfect. But this is Final Fight Ultimate, which is an upcoming Sega Mega Drive project, which is meant to be arcade-like version of Final Fight, but on the Mega Drive, which is, you know, really, really exciting. So far we've got essentially a 4-minute video of the first level playing in two-player. And this is obviously a fan project. It's not Sega putting out a new Sega Mega Drive game, which would be absolutely amazing. But this comes from a couple of guys. So this is Ray Costello. I believe his name is Muro Xavier. And then Master Lin Kuei, who we've actually spoke about before on the show, essentially remastering this game. And essentially, they're actually using like arcade assets and Sega CD assets to kind of recreate the game. Not completely create the game from the ground up, but they're using assets which are already available. And then Master Lin Kuei is doing a whole new soundtrack, but copying the original soundtrack, but using the Mega Drive hardware. So when you when you kind of watch it and listen to it, it is the original soundtracks of the game, but in the Mega Drive, and you can really tell it's that Mega Drive. Like I always call it the twang, you know, that like heavy guitar twang.
Yeah.
That the Mega Drive
kind of
gave.
Bit grungy, isn't it?
Yeah. You can definitely hear that in there. But what's really cool is that they're not cutting any corners. So you've got all the levels in there. You've got all three characters in there. And the biggest thing for me is that it is two-player as well. And there's also, by the looks of things from the description of reading it, there is also going to be a two-player mode where the computer is controlling player two as well in an AI mode, which is really interesting. And this is going to be running on the Mega Drive, you know, through EverDrive and actually running on, you know, Mega Drive hardware. Which is just, it's so cool. Like, I know this game's, you know, 33 years old now, and it's on 33-year-old hardware, but it's just insane to see what people can make, you know, these fan projects, you know. And I get it, the technology's changed and stuff like that, but ultimately, it's playing. It gets condensed and plays on the original, you know, on the original hardware, which I just think is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I think it's going to be really cool. And there is easier ways to play, you know, the arcade version now on like the Xbox 360 and the Xbox One. And there was even a Game Boy Advance port of it as well, which was fully two-player with all the characters and stuff. So, you know, it's not necessarily needed, but it's just really cool to see it playing on a Mega Drive and having, as I call it, the Mega Drive twang to the soundtrack.
It certainly beats the Amiga port.
Oh, yeah, there is. Yeah, we've seen that before and spoke about it. Yeah, it definitely beats that.
I wonder why it didn't come out on the Mega Drive back in the day.
Yeah, interesting. You know, that they did do it on the Sega CD, but not the Mega Drive. You know, you would have thought if they've got it running on the Super Nintendo, then they could do it on the Mega Drive. And it's Capcom as well. It's not like it's a small, you know, they weren't a small company. You know, they were one of the biggest third-party companies in the world. So it is odd that they did go for the Sega CD, unless they were convinced the future was in the Sega CD at the time.
Misled by someone. Yeah. Maybe a Sega. Yeah, this is going to be huge, yeah, while the really Streets of Rage on the side.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I do remember kids at school. I mean, there was definitely a rivalry between them. You know, the kids who had Mega Drives would be, you know, boasting about Streets of Rage. But the amount of kids that, you know, I knew a couple who had Super Nintendo, was not that many. But they'd always be like, oh, you know, Final Fight's a way better game. But I think there is something very cool about actually getting a game that was never released on a system back then and was kind of, you know, seen as a bit of a system exclusive, even though it did come out on the Mega CD, finally making it over to the other side. There is always something very cool about
it. Yeah, there's always something like kind of mind-blowing about that, you know, even for me, when I kind of got back into collecting, like at the time as I saw it as retro, but when I was like in my late teens, early 20s, you know, I didn't know that there was even a Sega CD version of it. It wasn't until I was older that it's like, oh my God, there's a Sega CD version of like one of my favorite Super Nintendo games. Like, and now it's just like, I just know if I found out about this when I was like a young guy and the Game Boy Advance version came out, it would have just blown my mind that it could run on the Mega Drive.
I'm just waiting for someone to port Super Mario World to the Mega Drive now.
Oh, I'm sure it's been done.
There's a challenge. So it looks really cool. If you want to check out that work in progress. Do you know if that's going to be a free game then? I imagine
probably going to charge for it. I don't think they'll be able to charge for that with Capcom and stuff. So I imagine it'll be free.
Hopefully it'll fly under the radar if it's going to be a free release. Yeah. So work in progress looks really, really good so far. Now, what about this for going real old school? What is generally regarded as the first ever video game you can now play on your analog pocket.
Yeah, do you guys know much about Space War?
Only from guests who we've had on the show. You know, when we get like real old school guests on who kind of started on the mainframe era, they always credit Space War with being the game they played on their university systems and stuff out of hours.
So it's one of the most important and most influential video games in early video gaming, and it was done in 1962 on the mainframe. Wow. So it was basically programmed and designed by Steve Russell. The whole idea behind it was a little battle between two spaceships, and you just had to basically shoot each other. It was designed on mainframe machines that were really uncomfortable to use. Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So I actually went to the Computer History Museum in America and played Space War on one of the old PDP-1s. The controls, my God, you will get cramp off those. They were not built for it. And it's so old, it used to run on tape. And I don't mean analog tape, I mean paper tape. So
like punch cards.
Punch carded tape that you'd actually, like ticker tape, and you put it in the machines. And then Space War ended up getting distributed in other mainframes as well. But it was like a direct influence for games like Computer Space, Asteroids, and the later ones. So it's a really interesting kind of piece of history. And
I mentioned Computer Space there. Obviously, that was the first arcade machine by Atari, wasn't it? So obviously, that was directly influenced by Space
War. Yeah, and I think, you know, people must have hated Space War when it came out. Because imagine you've spent all this money on a huge mainframe and the students are like locked in there playing this like game, and you're just like, right, we need this for research, or like,
we spent $100 million on that machine,
what are you doing? And they're all like, Space War, like,
chasing after, green after lines.
But now you can actually play this at home then.
I think there's been many ports, but you can actually play a portable version of Space War without a controller that's gonna absolutely wreck your hands.
So it's coming to the analog pocket, which, you know, you could say is a little bit of an odd choice, but the CEO of Analog, Chris Tabor, has said pretty much, you know, he kind of wanted to do it because of, as you say, it was this mainframe computer game, so it's kind of like bringing it to the masses and bringing the history to the masses, you know. And he goes on, he did an interview with The Verge, and he's essentially saying something that we're really into, it's about preservation as well and kind of bringing it to the masses so people can see, this is the first ever video game. Like, video games are such a huge, you know, thing these days, biggest media in the world. where did it all start? Started with Space War.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, Space War was on the vector display, kind of like a mainframe style one or oscilloscope or Vectrex, but it's coming out on an OLED screen. So I wonder how different it's going to look. And actually, maybe OLED might actually work quite well for that on the out of that pocket.
I think they've captured it quite well, you know, and, you know, they've even got like the blur to the spaceships kind of flying around. But what he does go on to say is this is it's not like a remake or anything like that. It is an actual port of the hardware, you know, because it's in public domain, the original kind of like hardware for it and stuff, the original coding and all that is there. So that's what they've made it from. And he said it was really hard to do it. And just because of like, obviously it was built on like vector graphics and stuff like that originally. So it was really hard to port it over, like you say, to like the OLED and stuff like that. It also begs that question of like, is it really going to sell that well, or, you know, download that well? Are people just going to kind of look at it and go, oh yeah, cool. And then that's it. Like,
have you played it before, Jay?
I haven't. No. Is it, is it really addictive?
It is really good. It's really playable. Like, the whole thing is you've got to fight, like if you played Asteroids, you've got to fight the enemy, but you've got to kind of use the right thrust, and it's very like the floatiness of it being in space kind of makes it really competitive. And it is actually an amazingly playable game for like being so early.
I have heard stories about people that kind of went into a zen-like kind of state playing it. You know, like back
space
in the day,
war mode.
Yeah, like lose yourself in it. So I do think it's a very, especially if you're doing something like the Analog Pocket, like you said, which aims to preserve this history, I think having, you know, what is regarded as the first ever game on there is definitely a good addition to the library. And obviously having a really simple way for modern players to kind of look back on it, I think is very cool.
Yeah,
as well.
Maybe we'll see some more of this. Like, I do think like Asteroids is an ideal fit for something like that. But maybe we'll see more of these like mainframe games or, you know, decent adventures like a 3D Monster Maze and Colossal Caves and stuff like that.
Well, I think, you know, we've kind of everything from the 80s and 90s seems to have been re-released. So why not go back a bit further
to the 60s?
So if you've got an Analog Pocket, it's coming to you very soon. Apparently, there's going to be a new update to it, to the Analog Pocket as well, that adds stuff like save states and all that too. So it looks very good. I'll link that up in our show notes.
We need to get one, don't we? An Analog Pocket. Check them out.
There you go. For the flight to Norway in a couple of weeks' time, Ravi, when we head off to Retro Mesa.
All three of us might be stuck on Space War.
Yeah, little mini land party on the plane. Which might be a good time to mention, actually, that we are off to Norway in 2 weeks' time, heading out to do some live panels at an amazing retro event called Retro Mesa.
Yes, it's going to be in Sandefjord, Norway. And Joe's first time in Norway, so I've been telling him that essentially it's like a Viking film, and you know, we're going to be going on a longboat and enjoying the whole place. No, it's going to be awesome. Really nice place. Great to kind of be in that kind of part of the world, and great to be doing events as well, actually.
Yeah, so if you haven't been before, if you're anywhere near Sandefjord in Norway, happens on the weekend of the 20th and 21st of August, or even if, like, you know, you're a plane journey away. I mean, it's like, what, an hour 15 from the UK? If you want to try something a little bit different, and we're going to be doing loads of panels there. The guys from Rare are going to be there. We've got Johnson John, Duke Nukem. He's going to be on stage with us. We're going to be doing our own panel on the Sunday too. There's a big retro gaming market, loads of games that you can play as well. So if you want to get tickets for that, I will link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. And it'd be nice to see some people in person again after when was the last event we did on stage, like back in 2019?
I think so.
It'd be nice to get back out there as well. And if you want something to listen to on your journey to Retro Mesa, just a quick heads up that we do have a new episode of our second podcast that we do each month, The Retro Hour After Hours, available right now. And actually this time, quite an interesting theme that we did. We talked about the best video game sequels of all time.
Yeah, that was really interesting because, Dan, you were a little bit worried. You were like, well, you know, every sequel in the video game world is better than the previous game kind of thing. But I kind of put it out to our listeners on socials as well and kind of blew up a little bit, which I really, really loved. And a lot of similar answers to what we all said, which I thought was really cool. But yeah, if you want to listen to that, that is our latest After Hours, which you know, we really got our teeth stuck into that. I think it was about 2 hours long in the end, that episode was. It was a big one. But what are we thinking of doing next time?
Well, we're thinking that we will play games that our patrons pick for us. So I'm going to put a little poll on our Discord and on our Patreon page. If you've got any suggestions of games, maybe stuff that we haven't played before,
we can kind of give our reviews of.
Yeah, we're thinking someone's going to give Ravi like Rise of the Robots 2 or something.
I just feel like somebody's going to make me play a load of Amiga, and I'm just going to have to go out and get Amiga 500 or something.
I'll loan you one, Joe. I've got plenty lying
around. Save me some money.
But yeah, so if you hop onto our Patreon this weekend, that poll will be on there if you want to suggest some games for us to play. And then not only do you get access to the After Hours podcast for getting us on Patreon, being a gold member or above, but really the main reason that we have a Patreon is obviously to keep the lights on, just to make sure that we can keep bringing the show out each and every week for you. And there's some other big perks that you get for backing us on Patreon too.
Yeah, you also get the episode early some weeks. You also get completely ad-free episodes, so you know you don't have to listen to any of those pesky ads or anything like that. You also get our monthly hangout, which we usually do on the last Sunday of the month, which, you know, we've said it before, it's a little bit like a pub hangout, hanging out with mates. We all get a drink, we all get some snacks, and we just kind of, I don't know, we lose ourselves talking retro. Sometimes we talk about films, retro tech, retro mobile phones, stuff like that. But yeah, all sorts of perks on there. And you kind of hear about what we've got coming up project-wise and stuff a little bit early, you know, and complete access to our Discord as well, which is really cool.
A couple of extra stories as well.
Yeah,
On the episode. So, you know, you get a lot for your money with the Retro Hour.
You get the Retro 2 Hour.
So any help that we get on Patreon, obviously it all massively makes a big difference to this show. And really, we couldn't do it without our Patreon. It is that simple. So anything you can spare, that really, really helps us out. And of course, for backing us on Patreon, you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. And that is...
Hall of Fame!
The Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And one new backer to give a massive shout to this week. Thank you so much to Gerardo Rodriguez, who backed us on Patreon. If you'd like to join him and join the Retro Hour Patreon community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Now, recently, it does seem like there has been a bit of a craze in retro first-person shooters. Been a lot of these coming out recently, and this one looks very cool. This one's called Compound.
Yeah, this looks really, really cool. So this is a VR game, which is on Steam VR and is also coming to the Quest 2. It pretty much looks like, to me, it's very in the vein of, like, you know, early FPSs like Wolfenstein and Doom, and the graphics are like a... I can only describe them as like they're like pixel graphics, but they're really, really beautiful. And it looks like a mix between Sprite and 3D, which I can imagine being a little bit trippy when you're playing
the colors as
playing
well.
Playing that in VR. But it is, like you say, a really bright, colorful game. And it looks really fun and really interesting. And it's getting a lot of good reviews. It came out a couple of days ago.
I think it looks like there was a certain era of PC games where... kind of CD-ROM had got a bit bigger and like games like Normality and stuff like that. And they had this kind of really colourful, cartoony kind of vibe to it. And it's got that, but it's also got that, yeah, you're right, like pixel kind of Duke Nukem style. But obviously it's all at a much higher resolution because of a VR. So this is kind of like something that we haven't seen before, and I've been out of the VR game for so long. I'm thinking of jumping back in, and this would be a ideal kind of title for me.
Looks like a good place to jump back in. So, you know, the reviews are in and they're pretty good, you know, lots of 9s out of 10s and stuff like that. It just looks really fun. So the aim of the game is essentially and the story of the game is you're a low level like worker for like a big evil corporation who are essentially, you know, making super soldiers and zombies and stuff, and, you know, out of slime and goo, essentially, it says.
Your standard kind of stuff.
Standard bad guys corporation. And you start off in the sewers of this huge building, and it's very in the vein of Die Hard. You're the bottom level and you're working your way up the tower. And as you get higher and higher, you fight more security and stuff like that. But you start in the sewers, and by the end of it, you're at the top of the tower. And the aim of the game is to just clear every floor. So you have to kill every enemy on every floor to progress to the next floor. Quite a short game, apparently only takes about 40 minutes to an hour to run through it, but I know a lot of VR games are like that, and it does save it. You can save it at any point, so you can just take your headset off and carry on with it, you know, when you want to later on. But it's got different difficulty settings, so you can play the game, you know, on very easy all the way up to like a nightmare mode. And apparently that does really change the dynamic of the game. The nightmare mode being really, you know, you kind of like have to be up on your feet, really kind of like looking around the corner, you know, making sure you don't actually get shot, really taking the game seriously. Whereas the easy mode, you can kind of sit in your office chair and just run in guns ablaze and just blowing everything away with double Uzi kind of thing, and just like an
action. That's my mode.
Yeah, that's my mode as well. But there's also a lot of like game changing things in there. You can take different syringes, which essentially alter the way the game plays. So you can have a lot more enemies, but they all only have one HP. So there's absolutely loads of enemies everywhere, but just one shot will kill them. Or you can have, you know, a couple of enemies who are really, really strong who you have to shoot all the time. I like the idea of lots of enemies that you're just blowing away with your guns. It just looks really, really fun.
It looks a lot more established. Like when I was first playing VR and stuff, you had to set the floor up and make sure you weren't going to fall into it. And like stuff would glitch, and like playing FPSs and stuff was kind of like a dream. I'd play like bow and arrow games and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I was still kind of tethered to the thing. So I can imagine this, just even looking at the videos of it, it looks so smooth and it looks like it wouldn't actually make me feel ill.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Well, if you think about like VR gaming, it kind of feels like the first person shooter is like one of the most logical genres to play in VR.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. But I think I've played maybe one in VR, which is interesting you should say that. But, you know, some people might be thinking, why are they talking about this new game? But it is the retro look of it, you know.
It's retro styled, but it's in a new dimension.
Yeah, 3D.
And if you think about those kind of 90s FPS games, I mean, obviously the pace of them is quite a bit slower than playing something like, you know, Call of Duty today. But I think, again, that probably lends itself better to VR, because otherwise it would just seem, you know, if you had like about 50 enemies on the screen at the same time and everything, and it would get a little bit overwhelming. So I think that kind of the slower pace of a 90s VR game probably lends itself.
For some reason, the graphics remind me of Theme Hospital.
Those colours.
Yeah, I can kind of see that.
In a version of Theme Hospital as well, shooting everything.
If you want to play Theme Hospital, shoot everybody up, play Compound.
That's
Ravi's
the next
review.
One. VR Hospital, yeah.
So it is getting some very good reviews so far. So if you want to play a 90s-style FPS game in VR, it's available now on Steam VR and coming to the Quest 2 very soon. And I'll link up that article in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, one of my favourite genres of video games as a kid was always pinball games. And I've got to say, actually having a decent pinball simulator on a computer is pretty tricky. There weren't many that did it very well, I don't think. But there were a few games on the Amiga in particular that I remember that actually were really good home simulations of pinball machines. Slam Tilt, I've got to say, was probably my favourite back then. Didn't you ever play that, Rev?
That's always your test. Dan always goes like, right, I'm going to test the emulation on this, see how it is. I'm going to play like Slam Tilt or Pinball Fantasies. And you can tell with the ball and the way that it's going and like the kind of smoothness. And I think that's a whole genre that we've kind of lost for a bit, you know, the pinball games on machines. Like, I really did enjoy them as well. And what we're talking about this because there's this Pinball Fantasies mini table. Now, this looks crazy. It's like, it's about the size of a phone. And it's probably using a phone screen as well. I'm not sure, but I've seen these kind of recreations. I saw a huge one, which was it was like a virtual pinball table. And it had like a giant screen on there. And that was also playing stuff like Pinball Fantasies and stuff. But this is in like miniaturized form, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, Slam Tilt was probably my favorite. But I think before that, Pinball Fantasies and Pinball Dreams, those Digital Illusions games. First time I played them, I mean, I hadn't played anything that kind of felt like actual pinball. Because it's a hard thing to get right, I think, on, you know, the weight of the ball and everything and the gravity. I think it got that really nailed in those games. But this is, I'll link it up in the show notes. It's on a website called spritemods.com. Someone has made a miniature Pinball Fantasies table. And actually, there is a video that's about 50 seconds long where the creator of it explains it. So I thought, why don't we hear from him?
This is my tiny Pinball Fantasies table. The case is 3D printed on a resin printer with some brass rods used as the feet and inside the plunger mechanics. There's an ESP32 S3 inside that runs the show. It has an x86 emulator that is just able to run the DOS version of Pinball Fantasies, and it's custom built to show the playfield and back box on the two LCDs you see here. It has an actual plunger to launch the ball and haptic feedback so you can feel the virtual ball bounce around. It can play all four Pinball Fantasies tables at the original 60 frames per second, and you don't even need miniature quarters to play them. More information, as usual, on spritesmods.com.
How insane does this look? Not only is it completely playable.
It's the DOS version.
The DOS version was pretty decent, actually. I didn't mind the DOS version of it. But the fact that he's got the little flippers on the side that you can kind of press probably with your little pinky fingers, a little plunger there that actually fires the ball.
It's the plunger that gets me that fires the balls. Disappointed that he's not made tiny quarters for it, though.
and it displays at the top as well, and it's got the kind of points light up there and stuff. The little marquee as well, which is pretty cool.
It does look an insanely advanced project. I mean, something that, you know, I can't imagine how he got all this stuff working together. It's way beyond my understanding, but yeah, it does look very cool. I think one thing I like about it as well is it kind of fits the entire screen of Pinball Fantasies onto the lower display, because normally in that game it kind of scrolled on your monitor, didn't it? I've never really played it where it's, the whole thing's full screen before.
Yeah, true, actually.
So it's kind of nice to see that.
There was always that scroll. And like, I love the kind of just the connection of, like, you know, we're getting mini consoles, we're getting, like, you know, miniature versions of everything. Of course there's going to be a miniature pinball machine and it's going to play Pinball Fantasies. Yeah, I love that.
And having that haptic feedback in there as well, so you actually feel when the ball is hitting the bumpers and stuff like that, I think is a very, very cool idea as well. So I don't know about you guys, whenever we go to, like, you know, play expos and that kind of thing, I'm always really drawn to the pinball table.
Yeah, well, when I went to America, God, the whole pinball culture there is absolutely massive. And, like, I think we have it in the UK, but not to that level. Like, there's still new machines being produced. And that kind of crossover with pinball and video games was always really tough. Like, you know, the pinball machines tried to get more video game technology in them, and the video games tried to emulate pinball machines. It's like a interesting kind of crossover. Yeah, I think this is really cool.
And always something that you felt like you couldn't have at home, because it's like, I mean, at a push, I could maybe fit an arcade cabinet in this room. I couldn't fit a full-size pinball table in here.
If you want to annoy the wife, then get a pinball machine.
Or if you want to keep her on your good side, make one of these mini ones. Yeah. So all the instructions are actually available on this website. So I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we are going to be joined by this week's very special guest, Reflections founder Martin Edmondson, coming up on the show in just a minute. Before we do that, though, maybe you've got a bit of travelling to do soon. Like you said, we're off to Norway. We're going to Germany in a couple of months as well. That'll be, you know, lots of time sitting at airports and sitting on planes and being bored. Maybe you need a good poolside book for your holiday, or maybe just a book to look really cool on your coffee table and celebrate a genre of gaming that is back big style at the moment. We're of course talking about point and click adventure games, and this is our lovely sponsor, Bitmap Books. Now, I mentioned that, you know, it does feel like point and click adventure games have had a real resurgence recently. We mentioned that new Simon the Sorcerer game coming out soon, new Monkey Island in the works as well. It kind of feels like the most exciting time in point-and-click adventure games that I can remember for years right now.
It's interesting. Like pinball games, it's kind of a genre that, you know, disappeared. But now it is definitely coming back. And it's great to kind of look back on those. You know, I was playing Thimbleweed Park and that was such an awesome title. Yeah, but there's so many good ones there as well, like Grim Fandango and like some of the later ones.
Discworld,
yeah, there's some fantastic titles out there. So it's great to have a book celebrating this genre.
And of course, this is Bitmap Books, and, you know, I don't think we're going to be too biased to say that they do the best quality retro gaming books. Every one I get from them, it's just like a real work of art. And it celebrates the look, the pixel art, the classic scenes from the best point-and-click adventure games. And actually, they've just released their third edition of the Art of Point-and-Click Adventure Games, featuring an additional 28 pages and some additional interviews in there as well, with legends like Dave Grossman, Dave Gilbert, lots more as well, and some additional games in there too. There's about another 6 or 7 games they've included. So if you're a fan of point-and-click adventure games, this book, a real celebration of that genre, clocking in at over 530 pages. This is an absolute must-have for fans of point-and-click adventure games. And you can check that book out, order it right now, and the rest of their retro gaming books on their website at bitmapbooks.com. Right, then next, we're going to be going inside Reflections, getting memories of the Driver series, Destruction Derby, of course, Shadow of the Beast as well, and lots more as we go poolside in Mallorca with our special guest this week, Reflections founder Martin Edmondson. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favorite bit of the show when we welcome on our very special guest. And it's an honor to be joined, not only taking the time out of his holiday, poolside in Mallorca, to talk to us by Reflections founder Martin Edmondson. How are you doing, Martin?
Good, thank you. Yeah, very good.
I hope you've got a nice cool drink in your hand if you're poolside on holiday.
Well, it's very hot, but I'm ready.
Well, I mean, let's kind of get into, you know, these incredible companies and these games that you've worked on. But before we do that, I mean, we always kind of like to get a bit of a background on our guests and find out where it all started for them. I mean, kind of going back to day one, what was your first ever gaming experience then? Do you remember what got you into it in the first place?
Yes, I mean, it was actually, it was the arcades. So my first recollection of any kind of gaming really was when we used to go to the local swimming pool or the ice rink or whatever when we were very young kids. And they had, you know, the stand-up arcade games. And the one that I remember was not Space Invaders, which is what most people say, but actually Williams Defender. I think it must have been around that era that I first noticed them. And although that was quite a complicated game, it had a lot of buttons, quite a tricky game, really. I just remember being totally transfixed by that thing and the sound effects and the explosions where they all disintegrated into particles and all that. Just I don't know why it hooked me, but that one did. I put a lot of money into that machine.
Yeah, and I think that game as well, I mean, you mentioned Space Invaders then, that just felt like just such a next level from Space Invaders as well, didn't it? Even though there's only a few years between them.
Yeah, I don't know if it, I can't remember, to be honest, if it was just purely a timing thing or whether I'd seen Space Invaders and just wasn't interested in it, but it was a total generational leap going from black and white to colour, but also just the sort of, you know, the whole thing scrolling and the sound and everything. It was a massive jump up. And that's the game that sort of grabbed me. But also I remember games like Centipede. What else was around that time that I played? Robotron, that was another amazing one that I put quite a bit of my lunch money and stuff into that I probably shouldn't have done. But that sort of generation of game. And it's also when the sound effects really did come off, because one of my lasting memories of Defender was that sort of growl when you first press the start button and the thump thump of the explosions with loads of bass. And that's where it started, really. Obviously, there was no involvement in creating them at that stage. It was just what sort of snagged my interest and made me appreciate them and sort of look at them and how they worked, really, how they worked, pull them apart. And eventually that led to writing games and wanting to somehow mimic some of this stuff that was going on, and much less advanced hardware.
Well, what was your first home system?
I remember getting the Binatone Pong type thing, which had about 10 games on it, and it was Pong, you know, the classic Pong, but there was also like a gridiron game and an attempt at basketball and stuff like that. And it was Binatone that made it, and it was very, very simplistic. It was black and white, if I remember correctly, and it was just all those sort of block graphics, and the ball was a little square and beep, pop, beep, pop, that sort of a thing. Mm. And that was around about that period of time. But the first actual system, I had proper system, computer that I owned, was my brother and I got for Christmas, lucky boys, a BBC Micro. And that's where it started in terms of having a computer and starting to learn how to program and mess about and experiment. And actually at school, we had ZX80 and ZX81, but I never had one of those at home. But that would have probably been 6 months to a year, probably a year actually, before BBC Micro. I'm talking off the top of my head on dates here. But we had a sort of a school club, computer club, I guess. And the teacher that ran the club had just got this ZX81, and you know, we did a bit of playing around on that at school, but mostly just playing games, to be honest, and a little bit of basic code stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, getting a BBC Micro for your first machine, you kind of went in right at the top there.
Well, yeah, it's obviously without that, there would have been nothing. So, you know, it was probably the most important moment. And it could have gone different ways, because we could have got, you know, could have got a Spectrum, we could have got a Dragon 64 at that time, we could have got a Commodore 64, which would have been pretty good actually, but lots of different things, and some would have sent you in the wrong direction. And but one of the things that was great about the BBC was that it was so programmable, and it was so, I wouldn't say easy to program, but certainly easy to be able to start programming, because the assembler was built in, and you know, had really decent, fast, basic built in. So you could kind of start straight away, whereas something like a Commodore 64 was a bit more of a mess on for somebody who was a true amateur. You had to, I don't think there was even an assembler built in. I think you'd have to get a cartridge that was an assembler and do it that way. But anyway, point being that the BBC was just designed to be programmed.
Let's talk about your kind of entry into the industry then, because I know you and a friend programmed a Raven Skull, and that was that Superior software that came out on. I mean, how did that project start, and how did you get in touch with them?
Although it was my brother and I that got the BBC for Christmas, it was a school friend who also had a BBC. His parents must have bought him it at roughly the same time. So we were both sort of lucky in that we shared the same machine. And remember, at the time, there were so many different machines, and a lot of those companies went bust and disappeared. But we both had the same machine. So we'd be around at each other's houses and tinkering around and playing around. And we started just writing little bits and bobs, and started a sort of like a Space Invaders-y sort of game. Didn't really get very far of it. And then the first game that we sort of designed properly and decided to have a proper crack at it and, you know, go to completion on the game was Raven Skull. So that was Superior Software. So they were based in Leeds. I remember we didn't totally finish the game, but we got almost, I would say, 90% finished. It took us about 6 months for the two of us to create that. And I remember just thinking, well, the best company, the best publisher for BBC Micro games at the time was Acorn Soft or Superior Software. And I think at the time, actually, Acorn Soft had been bought by Superior Software. It was probably around then. So anyway, long story short was I just jumped in the car and drove down to Leeds to meet with Richard Hansen, who ran Superior Software, and showed him the game, and he had a couple of suggestions to improve it, but liked it pretty much as it was, and said, yeah, we want it, we want to publish it. I've still got the letter from him saying, yeah, we'd like to publish it. So that's one of the few little trinkets I've got from the old days.
Nice. Well, obviously, I mean, he did a few more titles for the BBC as well. Why did he decide to stick with the BBC Micro? Because I imagine, you know, the Spectrum and Commodore 64 probably had, you know, much bigger gaming communities, and you could have sold a lot more on those systems.
Yeah, you could. But one of the advantages of being on the BBC Micro is there weren't that many games released for it. Well, you know, not compared to Spectrum and the Commodore 64. But on the other hand, well, I say there weren't as many games. There were lots and lots and lots of games made for the BBC, but there weren't that many sort of high-quality arcade-ish games compared to those other systems. So because it didn't have the focus from the gaming community, it did mean that when you released something, if it was high quality, it got a lot of attention. And because of that, you weren't sort of lost in the mix of a lot of other games, which you know, is something that's happening a lot, say, on mobile in more modern times. But back then, you could see how many releases there were on the Commodore 64. So standing out from the crowd was really quite difficult, whereas on the BBC Micro, you were only really getting one major release, maybe two major releases per month at all. So from that point of view, I suppose it made our job a bit easier.
Well, do you remember the first time you saw a Commodore Amiga, and what was your reaction to that machine?
Yeah, so I mean, the first time I saw a Commodore Amiga was in a little sort of backstreet computer repair shop called Curry and Morn, or Morn Micros in Newcastle, and they'd just taken delivery of this thing. And they had Marble Madness running on it, the original EA conversion. Larry Reed was the programmer that did that. And the whole point was to make it sort of arcade perfect, or as close as possible. And I was just blown away by that, because I had played Marble Madness in the arcades, and it was sort of almost indistinguishable from an arcade game, which I'd never seen before on a home system, because all of the big games that you would see come out on the 64 and the Spectrum, not so much on the BBC, because it wasn't really a gaming machine, as you pointed out, but they would never look anything like the arcade version. I'd rather spend £10 on the arcade machine than spend £10 on a, you know, a Spectrum conversion of OutRun, you know, for example. But, you know, that was really arcade perfect, pretty much, give or take. And I was just blown away by it. And I just thought that, oh, this is a machine I want to play with this thing and you know, learn how to program this and produce some stuff on it, because it just seemed limitless at the time.
Yeah, well, it felt like an arcade machine in your home, didn't it, that machine?
Yeah, well, it originally was designed as such, wasn't it? And they sold the whole thing to Commodore, and Commodore tried to sort of market it as a business machine for a while, and there was some quite well-documented fallouts between the original designers and Commodore that you can read through on Wikipedia that's quite interesting. But from a point of view of the hardware of that machine, with the Blitter and the hardware scrolling and the copper coprocessor that allowed you to do stuff, split screen, this, that, and the other, that we used to quite good effect in Shadow of the Beast in later years, was so clearly designed for video games and not for spreadsheets and stuff.
Let's talk about Reflections then, and forming Reflections. Where did the name come from originally?
It's a bit of a... I wish there was a better story to this, but all it was I was doing, I did the art for the games, and I was using a piece of, it was either Neochrome on the Atari ST or Deluxe Paint on the Amiga. I can't remember which now. And I just drew a silicon chip in space. It wasn't particularly designed for anything. It was just, I was drawing a silicon chip in space. And you could do like a 3D transformation of writing in the piece of software. I wish I could remember whether it was Neochrome or Deluxe Paint, but I can't. And I just wrote the word reflection across the screen, tilted it into 3D, and then reflected the word reflection in the top of the microchip. And I thought, oh, that's quite cool how you can do this. And then it kind of just stuck and stayed. And I wish there was something more elaborate to it, or some hidden meaning behind it, or you know, something that was really worth sort of digging into. But that was, it was almost like an accidental name. So when you hear the name, you know, people used to joke that, well, you sound like you're a hairdressing salon or something, you know. And I do wish we'd had something with a bit more oomph. But anyway, that's where it came from a drawing that I did of the word reflection on the top of a microchip floating in space.
Well, tell us about your relationship with Cyclaps, then, because I know they published Ballistics, and that was a spin-off label of Psygnosis, wasn't it, Cyclaps?
Yeah, well, it really was Psygnosis. It's just that they, at the time, they wanted to keep the Psygnosis name for their internal releases, you know, their big releases like Barbarian, Obliterator, and whatnot. And they developed this a sort of a side brand called Cyclaps, which was for the externally produced games. All the not as big games, you know, that were smaller games, easier games, not easier to play, sorry, smaller as in not huge production, puzzle games, things like that. And so Ballistics was a take on, I think it was our first 16-bit game, actually, and it was a take on the old physical game, Crossfire, where you fired the ball bearings at a little puck that we I had that one Christmas, and I remember, you know, playing it with my brother and giving myself a blister from that little gun that used to shoot the ball bearings, and it was a brilliant physical game to play. So we put together a demo using very simple physics for the balls bouncing, loads and loads of ball bearings, and put a demo together, almost finished. And I took that to see Ian Hetherington at Psygnosis, and that was partly because I wanted to start at the top when it came to publishing, because I really admired what Psygnosis had done with their whole sort of branding. You know, the black boxes, the big boxes, the Roger Dean artwork and all that. It just seemed so premium and almost mysterious at the time. And so rather than mess about going anywhere else, I just thought, right, I'm going to take it to Psygnosis, see what they think. Anyway, Ian looked at the game and really liked it and just thought, right, well, we'll publish that for you. No problem. I was really excited because I thought, oh, you know, that was sort of my first choice of publisher anyway. And they published it. I can't remember if actually Ballistics was on Psygnosis or on Cyclaps, but it was probably on Cyclaps because it wasn't an internally produced big game. And I'd done this quite elaborate logo for the name of the game, Ballistics, spelt with an X at the end. And it was elaborate in a sort of Roger Dean-esque, Rodney Matthews kind of thing with the spiky things off the letters, only because I really admired the artwork of Roger Dean. So I kind of copied his sort of style, nowhere near as well, I might add, but, you know, that style. And I think because I'd done that, they then got Roger Dean to do the logo for the game as well, which they didn't tend to bother with. Well, a lot of the Cyclaps games, I think they just got, you know, other logos. But anyway, they did it, and that was quite nice seeing him do that. And we chose a piece of artwork for it that was very appropriate to the game, with a sort of creature with wings throwing bombs. But that wasn't produced for the game. That was, I found that in a fantasy art book somewhere. Somebody Wright was the artist. I don't remember his full name. But anyway, it was a very suitable piece of artwork. We used that, and Roger Dean did the artwork for it. So although it was Cyclaps, it was still Psygnosis. It was a very internal thing, the way they did that. But it was the same people, the same team, same company.
Well, speaking of, you know, jaw-dropping games that I remember on the Amiga, obviously Shadow of the Beast, the amount of systems that game must have sold back in the day after people saw that in a shop and then their jaw just dropped when you saw that parallax scrolling and that incredible stylish game. I mean, tell us a bit about the background on that then and assembling the team. I mean, what kind of happened there?
Well, there wasn't so much of an assembling of team because we were a bunch of school friends, and some were involved, some weren't, and some, you know, they'd go off to university and or come back from university or abandon the course at university or whatever. So it was a sort of a changing, rolling team, really. But that started from, I got hold of the Amiga Hardware Reference Manual, Addison Wesley book, when I was nowhere near really writing anything on the Amiga. It was still one of those things that as soon as I'd seen the Amiga and seen what it was capable of by watching Marble Madness, I wanted to be able to work on it. So I got hold of that Hardware Reference Manual, read it back to back, and then designed what I thought was going to be possible with the parallax scrolling. So I talked before about the copper coprocessor that allowed you to split the screen, and then with it having hardware scrolling, which I was never used to from the BBC Micro, which, you know, did have hardware scrolling, but it only 8 pixels at a time, so it was as good as useless for a lot of purposes. And it just seemed to be perfect for what we wanted to do. And I'd noticed, you know, parallaxing is something that anybody can see by just looking out the side of a train. You can see how stuff closer to you is whizzing faster than stuff further away. So I just designed it on a piece of paper, really, was where the splits would be, what the speeds would be for each of the splits, and we ended up with 13 layers, and how we'd use different play field modes on the Amiga, because it was so powerful, it was so flexible, that machine. It had different ways of setting up what could overlay what, how many colors would be in it, and people used to talk in terms of the sprites being the most powerful thing, but they weren't at all. The most powerful thing was the coprocessor and the split screen hardware scrolling and the way that you could have entire screens overlaying it, other entire screens in separate play fields. It was a very, very flexible, powerful gaming machine. So, you know, designed on paper, we finished whatever game it was that we were working on and just got stuck into that as a demo. So that what happened was that Ballistics had just been recently published, and I took a demo of Shadow of the Beast, which was only the introduction screen. I don't think you could even run around. It was just the ground split up, scrolling, and a tree and a cloud and the blimp and all that stuff. I think I'd put the Cygnosis logo in just to sort of sweeten the pie a bit. And and Ian saw it, and just, it was amazing because he just sort of gathered everybody in the company around it. It was like, oh, you've got to come and have a look at this. You've got to have a look at this. And all the technical guys and, you know, and the marketing guys, everyone's just sort of crowded around it and just, right, we've got to do something special with this, which was really nice to see because I deliberately designed it in a sort of Cygnosis way in terms of the graphics and the fantasy art that Barbarian had, you know, and it was that sort of thing. So I suppose from that point of view, it was also an easy sell because it had the look of a Cygnosis game as well, but plus the, you know, the technical abilities that were afforded by the hardware for the nice arcadey scrolling.
And I remember, you know, like I mentioned before, when I first saw that game, I was just blown away by the graphics on it, because I come from a Commodore 8-bit machine. I had a Commodore 16 before it, so kind of want to leave that one, see Shadow of the Beast. And, you know, all my friends were the same. If you wanted to show off what an Amiga would do, you'd put Shadow of the Beast on to show other people. I mean, did you get much of a reaction from Commodore then? Because that must have helped sell a lot of Amigas.
Yes, it did. I believe I was told it did. And I suppose it's believable from the point of view of most Amiga games at the time were ports of Atari ST games. And that was because the Atari ST at the time was a much bigger machine, bigger installed base. And the Amiga was, you know, newer and much more expensive. Therefore, you just didn't expect to sell that many on the Amiga. And the approach that we'd taken was, if we do a game which is 100% tailored towards this machine and is not going to be physically possible to write on any other machine, to play on any other machine, then that will appeal to those people so much that it would sell machines, or if not sell machines, anybody with that machine would buy it, because that's a real show it to my mates, right? This is why my Amiga is better than your ST, that sort of an approach, that sort of a game. And I thought it was quite brave of Cygnosis as well, because they didn't really know. They were basically ignoring the ST, which was the bigger base, to publish this game and spend all this money and the t-shirt, the box and all that stuff that came with it on a very small, at the time, installed base, and hope that it was impressive enough to actually get a big, a big proportion of the owners of the machine buying it.
Well, going from Shadow of the Beast 1 to number 2, did you kind of feel more of a focus on gameplay was needed for the second one then? And how did you kind of improve that?
Yes, the first game was, I would be the first to sort of acknowledge that the gameplay was somewhat simplistic, and it was really a sort of technical tour de force to show off the Amiga's hardware. That's really how it was designed, both from the graphics that you've talked about, the sound, everything was very much pushing the hardware and the visuals and the audios of that machine. But by doing that, the modes that we'd chosen, the playfield system, it limited some of the things that you could do. So, you know, you'll notice things like if you punch one of the monsters, he sort of disappears through the ground. He doesn't go flying over the cliff or whatever. He disappears into the ground. And it was partly to do with the technical limitations of how we'd set it up to demonstrate the hardware. So we'd got ourselves in a bit of a box, I suppose, got ourselves in a corner, which limited the game design quite a lot. And we were aware that basically there wasn't a lot to it as a game. So the idea with the second game was to give more flexibility on what we could do with things, like what monsters could do, where they could be on the screen, how many of them there could be, etc., etc. And that's how the sort of change in graphical approach came, to allow us to do more stuff. And we had things like, you know, by Shadow of the Beast 3, we had some really quite advanced puzzles in there, some of them that played out like text adventure type puzzles, but in a sort of physical way, like bursting people out of cells and things like that.
Well, obviously by the mid-90s, it felt that everyone had to have like a cutesy animal mascot for a game, and Reflections did Brian the Lion. There was another game that was published by Cygnosis. What kind of memories have you got of that project then?
That was a total break for us. That was done within the company by one of the artists who wanted to produce a game that was a platformer with a cutesy animal, very playable sort of a thing. And I was still very much in the mode of pushing the hardware. And we had a very, very, by that time, we had a very, very technical programmer, a guy called Mike Troughton, who was just very clever with what you could do with hardware. And what we were able to do was do sort of both. So it was a platformer with a lion with a roar that was so loud that he kind of scared himself, and we could do all these funny little things with it. But the hardware stuff was still there. I don't know if you remember all the effects in that game, but we were doing full screen hardware rotation in 60 frames a second, which was something that the Amiga was not supposed to be able to do. But at the time, the Nintendo had just come out and was doing full screen rotation effects and everything. And we showed that game to to Commodore, and they loved it because it was a bit of a, yeah, well, you know, you can do this, but we can do it as well type of a thing. And they took it on as a wanting to box it, you know, with the machine. So you would buy the Amiga and you would get Brian the Lion with it. And, you know, and it suited them because it was a bit of a show of the graphical power as well. And there was other stuff, like you could play in levels that were like the inside of a rotating tube, which was all stuff done with the copper and the hardware scrolling again. But, and then overlaying enormous platforms that were rotating left and right and all in 60 frames a second. It really, I mean, from a technical point of view, it was way, way, way ahead of Shadow of the Beast. And unfortunately, I'm not sure if it was quite as simple as this, but Commodore basically went bust just before this was launched. So that whole deal sort of fell apart and really kicked us in the teeth, because it was going to be quite a big thing, you know, to have the game sold with. And the box, you know, it was like the Commodore Amiga box. And it had Brian the Lion on it and this, that, and the other. And it would have been great. But anyway, it all fell apart. Commodore went to the wall and then we just, it ended up being published. But, you know, cutesy character just wasn't that appealing. And it didn't come anywhere near the expectations or, you know, the sales of Shadow of the Beast. But it was quite a long time after that. And there were a lot of other Amiga games then that were using the hardware. So kind of got a bit lost, which was a shame.
Did you kind of see that coming with Commodore then? Or was it quite a shock when they suddenly went under?
You could see a bit of it. You could see bits. It was, they were competing with bigger companies that had a lot of money, and, you know, things were taking off with the consoles, the Nintendo and the Sega consoles, and money was starting, you know, they were spending money that Commodore didn't have. And I wouldn't say that I was expecting them to go pop like they did, but you could tell that they weren't going to be able to compete. But no, it wasn't like there wasn't a moment where we thought, right, this is what's happening, until it actually happened, unfortunately.
Because I had Brian the Lion on the CD32 that was an Amiga CD console. What do you think of the CD32 then, and why did you choose to support that system?
Well, because it basically was an Amiga, so it was not hard for us to do it. And there was also a little bit of support from Commodore, so they wanted that Brian the Lion to launch on it. Because, again, like I said, it had caught Commodore's eye because of all of the hardware tricks that we were doing and really sort of showing off what the Amiga could do. But it wasn't like the CD version of that machine was any better, really, apart from obviously having the CD drive. The hardware, as far as I can remember, was either identical or very similar. But as a new machine trying to catch attention, you know, they offered a bit of development and marketing support and stuff, the kind of thing that makes you say, yeah, we'll convert it onto that machine, because the game was already written and it was using very similar hardware. So it wasn't like a, you know, start from scratch job or anything. Unlike some of the conversions of, you know, Shadow of the Beast, for example, that went on to 13 different formats, and some of them just must have been an absolute nightmare to start from scratch and try and duplicate.
Well, after the Amiga, obviously it felt like the entire world just kind of moved over to the PlayStation. And obviously you were the same with Destruction Derby. Tell us a bit about Destruction Derby then, kind of the history of that. And how early did you have access to the PlayStation hardware?
Well, we were very lucky there in that we had this solid relationship with Psygnosis, obviously from the Amiga days. And they were in the throes of this deal with Sony, which we knew about but didn't know too much about it. You know, Sony taking over Psygnosis, and the thinking being, you know, that Sony's going to launch this console. They need a publishing partner, or they need to own a publisher. They need some launch titles because, you know, Sony didn't have the gravitas that Nintendo and Sega did at that time. So to, you know, to get people on board, they needed, I suppose, to own a publisher or a developer. So we were already in there with them. I remember Ian Hetherington saying, right, everybody, come up with some game ideas, game designs, just on paper, basically. And I scribbled out. I mean, I'd always wanted to do a game with crashing cars, but it just was never possible to do it, you know, to my satisfaction anyway with anything other than perhaps some really high-end PCs, but you know that we weren't working on PCs at the time. But I designed this system of crushing polygons together and making them look like they were bent and buckled, but also crucially having the textures, high resolution, high bit depth, photographic, photorealistic textures of smashed up cars, using a very simplistic mesh. So not relying on the mesh buckling, but relying mainly on the textures. And anyway, so I scribbled all this out in a document that was, you know, just 4 or 5 pages long. It was very, very short. And at the time, a lot of developers were sending these enormous documents, a very complicated game. And one of the advantages of ours was it was such a short document. People would pick it up and read it, and it wouldn't take very long. And it was also, you know, quite compelling because it was smashing up cars and it was a very short document. And you could just sort of imagine in your own head how that might turn out if it was done well. And we had a little bit of a battle at the beginning, not with the main guys at Psygnosis, but some of the product review guys thought it sounded far too similar to an arcade game, Daytona, by Sega. Mm. I just didn't get that at all. What it was that you could damage your car in the Daytona arcade machine, if you remember. And it would sort of make the car wobble around and bent bent the bonnet up a bit. And, you know, what we were proposing was something far more, well, the game was actually about that. You know, the whole point of the game was to turn around, head in the other direction, smash the cars to pieces. And it was not really a race at all. So it got a bit misunderstood by some people. And I just always remember being in a meeting where Ian Hetherington just stood up in this meeting and said, look, we are doing this game, whether you like it or not, we are doing it. And I just thought, oh, right, brilliant, right, we've got Ian Hetherington on board here. So he's, you know, we're going to get it done. And then straight after that, within a day or two, we had a development kit in our office and, you know, contractual stuff was starting to get moving and we got the development kit in the office, and within a day, the lead programmer, Mike Troughton, had this, you know, polygon spinning on the screen, and within a week, a car spinning fully textured. So it was very, very rapid, actually, because that machine was quite sort of developer-friendly, unlike perhaps some of the later PlayStations, but certainly the first one was. So we got it up and running quite quickly, and within a week, we had this car on the screen that was driving around a track. It was all very makeshift, but it was driving around, and it really showed you visually how the game could look. And it was so fast up and running that the ball started moving very quickly, because it wasn't just a document anymore. It was actually something that you could look at. And then within a month of that, we built a demonstration of the collisions. And it wasn't the game. It wasn't, you couldn't drive around, but what you could do is you could position cars anywhere you wanted in a world, and you could fire a car at them. And it was the full damage model that you see in the final game, all the physics, all the destructive textures and whatnot, bits flying off them and so on. And because it was so flexible, you put cars anywhere you want, we produced this video that just said, this is what the crashes are going to look like. And it did for the time. It looked pretty amazing, really, because it was properly destructive and really quite satisfying. And I remember sitting up right through the night one day in the studio, setting up lots and lots of different collisions and picking the ones I thought were the best ones to show to them. And that went off to Psygnosis, and that's when everybody got on board, because it was like watching a video of just, you know, cars being smashed to pieces. And then there was no more persuading needed. It was it was off, and we produced the game relatively quickly. Killed us nearly mind. It took 6 months to produce that game, and pretty much a 7 days a week thing.
Were you attending many destruction derbies or banger races, like for research?
Yeah, so it was when I was young, really young, my dad used to take me and my brother to see real destruction derbies and real banger racing in the UK. And we used to go all over the country and watch these things. And that was, you know, what I was, I guess, 5 or 6 or something. And I would jump over, when the destruction derby had ended, I'd jump over the railing and go and inspect all the damage on the cars. I had this really strange obsession with smashed to pieces cars and car chases in films and all of that. And I used to just run around the cars and just have a look at them. So when it came to the research for this game, I went to the same racetracks with the DSLR. DSLRs had just about come out then. And photographing every single car that went out, and the same car when it came back in. I went to 40, 50, 60 real banger races all around the UK whilst the team were, you know, building the game. And what I was after was a progression of five textures from the front, five textures from the back, five textures of a door, a photographic that we didn't have to fiddle with, that were one car gradually getting more and more smashed up. And the car, if you notice, was at the old boxy Ford Granada for the simple reason that at that time, that was the car of choice at real British banger races for a few years. So it needed to be the same car. It needed to be consistent and needed to show that progression of damage. So that's the car that was, you know, was actually used. And eventually, after watching 30, 40, 50 real banger races at different locations all around the country, I'd managed to get a progression of a Ford Granada in five stages of perfect increasing damage. And those were the textures that went on the cars.
Amazing. You know, actually, I remember the first time I saw Destruction Derby, that was on the PlayStation magazine demo discs, you know, the CDs that came on the front of the mags. I mean, how important were they to a game's success back then, would you say?
They probably were. I'm not sure how important it was to Destruction Derby, because Destruction Derby was basically a launch game, or a UK PlayStation launch game, and it had masses of attention anyway, and we'd got a lot of front covers. I mean, pretty much every PlayStation magazine at one stage had Destruction Derby on its front cover. So there was a huge amount of press and visibility anyway for that game. Plus the fact that the only game you could buy, the only games you could buy during that first launch week or few weeks was Wipeout, Ridge Racer, which was the Japanese launch title, Toontown Racing that was Polyphony, that then became later the Gran Turismo series, but they did a cartoony game first, and Lemmings 3D, I believe, and then, you know, one or two others, but very, very few games. So, you know, if you were doing something that was different and quite sort of visually impressive and you know, smashing cars, who doesn't love smashing cars? It sort of sold itself almost.
Yeah, and I think for the audience that the PlayStation was going for, like, you know, teenage boys, you couldn't get better than smashing up a car.
Yeah, yeah, and it had tons of support from the publisher. Obviously, Psygnosis really pushed it. They had a high level of confidence in it. We'd have, you know, press days, and we'd have 20, 30 magazines from all around the world would come and see us in Newcastle, and we'd show them the game. And you know, you could just tell that everybody really liked it. So it just means that there's a sort of a wave of anticipation and excitement coming anyway. So, you know, we knew it was going to be successful. It's just we had no idea quite how successful it was going to be.
Because I remember we've spoke to, like, the Oliver twins on this podcast before, and they told us a while back that they, you know, they saw that T-Rex demo, you know, that everyone was showing on the PlayStation demo, and they tried to develop a game for it, but the industry reception they were getting was, you know, a lot of companies were holding off a bit, so like, you know, well, Sony's it's a hi-fi manufacturer, they don't know consoles. But obviously, I imagine the fact that you're in there with Psygnosis, that must have instilled a lot more confidence, I imagine.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I mean, Psygnosis, you know, they'd been bought by Sony, so that was their entire job was to deliver games for this system. You know, and the budget was no longer coming from Psygnosis, really. The budget was coming from Sony, who produced the console. So, you know, everything lined up well. And you can understand, you know, the EAs of this world and many others going, let's just see how this goes before we spend proper money on the development. Because the development budgets for these games, you know, had just taken a serious step up if you were going to compete at the level that the system demanded to be visually competitive. So you can understand why there'd be a bit of trepidation, but we didn't suffer from that at all because of the lucky timing and the lucky position that we were in with respect to the publisher.
Well, obviously, by the time Destruction Derby 2 came along, that was, you know, a big improvement in technology and features as well. I mean, did that game kind of help develop Driver?
No, there was no similarity at all, but Destruction Derby 2 was another example of wanting to expand the game at the expense of other things. So in many ways, there were things I prefer, I'm talking personally here, but there were things that I still preferred about Destruction Derby 1. I liked the fact that you could see every single car on the track at one time. You know, you didn't have 20 cars spread around a track that was 10 miles long. You could see everything at the same time. And so the destruction tended to keep the cars quite bunched together, and that would be quite exciting because you get a lot of high impact crashes and multiple cars. It would look carnage, really. But what we wanted to do with Destruction Derby 2 is make the tracks more interesting, make them longer, make the racing more interesting, make it so that the cars could actually now flip, and a few things like that that really expanded the game. And it did well. It did very, very well. It was reviewed well, and I'm still pleased with what we did in terms of expanding the game. And sometimes get these sort of lazy sequels. I think we've all been guilty of those at some stage, but you know, that definitely wasn't a lazy sequel. That was a huge amount of work. We scrapped almost everything. There were very few shared lines of code between Destruction Derby 1 and Destruction Derby 2, just because of the different scale of what we were trying to do with it.
Well, let's get into Driver, because obviously that was such a groundbreaking game. Tell us a bit about the development on that then, and what were kind of the biggest challenges of doing that first game?
Well, the idea for Driver came actually whilst I was in the middle of the playing the cross, the figure of eight cross over track in Destruction Derby. And years and years ago, I'd planned to do a game where you were sort of like you were a cop responding to emergencies and stuff like that. Anyway, it was a seed of an idea. It never got used because you could only ever do top down. There was not particularly what I wanted to do, but I was playing with the crossover track. And I just remember pulling up at the crossover, at the crossroads, and thinking, wouldn't it be great if you could have, there were like traffic lights here, and instead of going straight ahead, you could choose to go right, which you could anyway in Destruction Derby. You could go right or left or straight on. But for it to be a proper working traffic system where the lights would change to red and everyone would stop and you could just do what you wanted. You could cause carnage, or you could stop at the lights and, you know, turn left, turn right and all that. And that was the point at which I thought, right, let's just play this like it's a real street system and pretend that's what it is. And it was compelling just to mess about in that way with it. And the idea, unfortunately, had to just sit there and wasn't used for, well, at least a year, because Psygnosis had sort of demanded a sequel to Destruction Derby, which made perfect sense and, you know, didn't have any objections from me, because we knew that, you know, it would be successful if we did a good job of it. So we just had to divert the resources into that, and it just sort of sat on the back burner. And once later editions of Destruction Derby were coming out, they were nothing to do with us. So we didn't create the DD3 or arenas or anything like that. But we were free to develop something else. And that's when the development for Driver kicked off. Initially on the PC, actually, because we weren't sure whether the PlayStation's hardware was going to be up for it, because it having an open street system, it demanded a lot of both texture and geometry data. And the only way that we thought that could possibly work on the PlayStation would be to live stream it off the DVD?
CD, wasn't the PS1, yeah.
It wasn't even a DVD. Yeah, so the amount of data that you couldn't store it all in memory is what I'm getting to, is it had to be streamed, and we just didn't know whether it would work. And the initial libraries and stuff that supported development on the PlayStation didn't allow that, and you weren't really allowed to tinker too much. Some of the Japanese developers, Sony themselves, did, but we weren't really allowed to, even as Psygnosis. We were very limited in what we could do. But anyway, as time went on, they started to develop more of these the tools and the engine stuff that allowed you a bit more tinkering and poking around. And it took us a while to have the demonstration on the PlayStation that you could actually stream the data at a sufficient enough rate. Whilst you're playing the game, remember, it was no good stopping and downloading all the data. This was something that had to happen whilst you were playing without impacting performance too much. And also, remember that a game like Driver, if you decide you want to go left and not right, you're all of a sudden streaming different data. So you've got to pick up the head on the CD drive, send it somewhere else, start streaming that. Again, all of it had to be seamless. You couldn't stop the game to do that. And all this stuff had to be tested out. We just had genuinely no idea if it was going to be possible or not. Anyway, you know, after months of messing about, many, many months of messing about and testing and doing little demonstrations, we managed to get it working well enough and continue to optimize it. And actually, it worked really well. You know, you could drive in any direction as fast as you wanted. You were never aware of any loading, really. So we then swapped the lead development from PC onto PlayStation, and the PlayStation became the dominant platform. Because at that stage, it wasn't Psygnosis that was publishing it. At that stage, I was developing it myself and paying for it myself. and planning to choose who would publish it at the end. And very long story short there is that Psygnosis or Sony were going to publish it. And then along came GT Interactive and instead said they couldn't match the Sony's offer for publishing, but they could buy the company. And we went down that that route in the end. But it was a PC game at the time because it wasn't a game directly for Sony at that point. But we were very glad in the end it did lead on PlayStation for obvious reasons, because by then the PlayStation was a massive installed base and was the prominent platform.
And that Driver's got like a notoriously tough start for a new player. I mean, was it a kind of conscious decision to make it for like hardcore gamers?
I think it was more of an accidental thing that back in the day, games used to be designed by the programmer or the artist. There were no focus groups. There was no, even very little, if any, input from the publisher saying, no, change this, change that, or that's too hard. People don't like that. People would rather this, you know, and so on. That you have in a modern, sensible development, you have a lot of focus and attention on it to make sure that you've got playability right, difficulty right, and, you know, and so on. So it was really down to us as a developer and ultimately down to me how hard that game was. And I was a hardcore game player. So unless it was brutally hard, I thought it was too easy. And we did make that garage thing far too hard, I think, in retrospect. But I thought, well, I can do this garage sequence in 23 seconds. Therefore, if we give people 60 seconds, that's I think, too much. And, you know, clearly it wasn't, but it was far too hard. And also, you know, design decisions that you would never dream of today, like you couldn't progress into the game itself, the game proper, until you'd completed that test, you know, effectively, properly finished it, completed it, ticked all the boxes, done it in under the time limit. You would never, ever design a game like that now. You might have that test in there, but you would say, okay, you failed it five times now or whatever. Would you like to just proceed without having, you know, that would be the sensible way to do things. But that's the way games were designed back then, certainly by us and many of my friends at the time. Was just, you know, it was up to you how hard you want to make it. And I wanted to make it hard. I didn't like easy games.
Well, Driver 2, you know, really felt like it was pushing the limits of the PlayStation 1. You know, the hardware was kind of creaking under that game. You were pushing it so hard. I mean, was it a challenge to make that game with less time? And obviously you had options like, you know, getting out of the car and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, it was pushing the hardware. I mean, Driver 1 was pushing the hardware hard, but actually, you know, with later developments and optimization, we could have had even more out of Driver 1 if we'd had more time and more, you know, more time for optimization and rewriting bits and bobs in newer ways and so on. But Driver 2 was probably definitely biting off more than it could chew with that CD system for the streaming, because some of the key things that I wanted to change and improve for Driver 2 were more cars, more variety of cars, you know, school buses and vans and trucks and cars and everything. Whereas the cars in Driver 1, there were just two cars and that was it, two designs and that was it. And also for the cities to be not just American cities that are a crisscross of blocks and streets, you know, with 90-degree bends, but to have proper curving tracks and up into the hills and what have you. And to do all of that, the amount of geometry and car data that had to be pulled off the drive was massively higher than Driver 1. Mm. And we never really quite nailed that. We just ran out of time. So the game was could be stuttery at times. It wouldn't run as smoothly as Driver 1. I do regret not having had a little bit more time. And it was only probably a bit more time just to optimize all that. But at the end of the day, you know, you run out of time. But all the stuff to do with getting out the car and the changing cars and, you know, that all worked really well, and I was pleased with the game in the end, and the story was much better, and the cutscenes were better, and the music was better, and the missions were more varied because of the added flexibility and also the different cityscapes instead of just being US cities. So that was all good, and it was a huge amount of work in it. Nearly again, it was another game that nearly killed us in terms of the amount of hours and effort that went into it. But with the exception of that stuttering that it suffered because of not being able to draw enough off the drive, I think everything else we were very pleased with in that game.
Did you ever get frustrated with the constant comparisons with Grand Theft Auto? Because, I mean, obviously they're very much separate games, but did you kind of feel like the media was creating a bit of a tech arms race between the franchises at the time?
Yeah, probably they were. I mean, I remember reading the stuff. But at the time, they weren't really comparable because Driver was on PlayStation 1. I mean, Grand Theft Auto was PlayStation 2, wasn't it?
GTA 3.
So, there were GTAs before the top-down view that Dave Jones and the DMA guys did, but that was, you know, you couldn't compare that to Driver. But that was a top-down, you know, stealing cars, I guess, and doing all those sort of baddie missions and stuff. But GTA, the one that most people think about GTA was the Liberty City GTA 3 or GTA 3D, but that was PlayStation 2. So that came out after Driver 2. So Driver 2 was the first to have the getting out the car, but we didn't do anything with it really, apart from changing cars. We just wanted a realistic way of swapping between cars. That was it. There were some missions where you'd flick a switch or whatever, but we didn't use it very much. You certainly didn't have a gun or anything like that. It was all just pretty simplistic stuff. GTA was less about the car when it came out. GTA 3 was less about car chases and more about the missions out, the foot and shooting and all the stuff that GTA is famous for. So they were very different at the time. I mean, things converged later on when we did more out-of-car stuff and they did more focus on the cars as well. So the conversion that way. But not at that stage. You know, Driver 2 came out. I don't remember how long before Grand Theft Auto, but it was on a, you know, previous generation machine. So it must have been a year or two. And then GTA took that getting out of cars and missions far, far further than Driver and did it obviously very successfully. It was an amazing game, but amazing for different reasons.
I know Driver 3 had a bit of a troubled development cycle from what I've heard about it. I mean, what happened there from your perspective then with Driver 3?
Driver 3 was, that was moving on to a new system, newer PlayStation. The issue there was just really biting off more than we could chew and doing, I think, too much of the out-of-car stuff that we didn't really have much experience with. Didn't have any experience with apart from what we'd learned during Driver 2. And by then, Grand Theft Auto had been out and others where you're sort of running around open streets and stuff and had been quite well developed. And we were coming at it from the first game. And I was very happy, actually, with all the car stuff. So all the stuff that you did in the car chases, the dynamics, the smashing them up and the missions involving cars. But we just really just didn't get the out-of-car stuff finished. And there was a lot of pressure from the publisher as well in terms of, their well-documented financial difficulties. And the game had to come out no matter what. Absolutely no option. This is the date. And we just couldn't get it finished we couldn't get the out-of-car stuff finished to the point that we wanted it to be finished. So it was quite buggy and the AI was just not well-rounded, not well-formed. A lot of scripted stuff going on with the characters out of the car. And if you'd been used to something like Grand Theft Auto, you know, where they've spent a lot of time on that and it looked and it all sort of was well, you know, well known and well played. It was really quite simplistic and we shouldn't have. It was my fault for wanting it to have everything. And the thing is, you need a lot of time and a lot of people for that. And you also can't be saying this game comes out on this date, no matter what. So was a bit of a victim of a number of different things, but basically me pushing too hard, as is, you know, happened various times in games we've been developing, just wanting more and more and more to the point where actually it would have been better with a bit less.
I guess the difference then was, you know, now you just push some updates down, wouldn't you, over Xbox Live or PSN. When you had it pressed on your PS2 disc or an original Xbox, wasn't quite as simple for most people, I imagine, to do patches.
No, it wasn't. No, well, I don't remember even if you could do patches at all then. I mean, you could do a patch in terms of a new run, the CD or the DVD, but that's not the same, is it? Because people already have the game in their hands. Unfortunately, when you have a deadline that you have no choice about, you then can't... I've had people say to me, well, why didn't you just pull out a load of missions? And the thing is, you can't actually do that because by doing that, you've then wrecked the... what's going on in the story and things don't make sense anymore. So you're sort of a bit stuck. You've made your decisions. You've decided you're going to push the envelope in these different directions and that's it. You've just got to live with it. And unfortunately, we just ran out of time. I think we would have got there, but we would have got there. It would have taken a lot longer than any of us envisaged. You know, the out-of-car stuff is just very, very, it's very difficult to get it well and working properly and we just run out of time.
Well, Driver, I mean, has still got, you know, fans all over the world. And it's been quite a while since we last had an installment in the series. I mean, would you like to see it come back in some form?
Yes, I would. I mean, we did, the last one that we did was Driver San Francisco. And we were very, very pleased with that. I mean, that was another one which was pushing the limits of the hardware to the absolute limit. And that was a great experience working with Ubisoft, because they were very much about quality. The deadline didn't matter as much. It was about quality. And they made a decision. Just one simple example of this was they just suddenly mandated that, yeah, we think this is all great, the zooming in and out of the cars and the city and everything, but we want it to run in 60 frames a second. And I remember sitting with the programs just thinking, oh my God, you know, this is doing a lot as it is. How are we going to hit 60 with something that's going to do this, and you can zoom right up to the top of the city and look down on it like Google Maps and just instantaneously zap into these other cars and suddenly be in them, and they've got a new dashboard, they've got all the audio, and the car's a totally different car, and there's hundreds of cars in the game, and how's this all going to go? Anyway, the long story short was that it basically added a year, if not 2 years, to the entirety of that development just to optimize, rewrite to get that game running in 60 frames a second. And, lots of people appreciate that, but I bet there's a good few that wouldn't have cared whether it was in 60 or 30, but Ubisoft did, you know, and that's what they wanted. They wanted it in 60 frames a second, and I was always a sucker for frame rate. I loved 60 frames a second just from back in the old arcade games, where all arcade games ran in 60 frames a second, and get used to it. And it's a luxury, but it really made a huge difference. So, you know, we pushed and pushed and pushed, but we had all the time in the world that we wanted to do that, and the resources in terms of the quality of the staff, the number of the staff in the team, who we could pull on from external studios for help with this and that. It just was a whole different ball game to the GT Interactive experience, where they're a company in difficulty. So that was a great experience. So we were very pleased with what we ended up putting out with that game.
Well, Martin, I know you're on holiday and you've got family engagements this afternoon, so we won't keep you too much longer, but it's been incredible reminiscing with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time talking to us. I mean, can you tell us what you're working on these days? Is there anything we should keep an eye on coming up?
I'm working on my holiday at the minute.
Yeah.
nothing to report yet, no.
Well, Martin, thanks so much for coming on and being our guest, and enjoy the rest of your holiday.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.